Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
The newer guidelines, I think they come with this big innovation, which is recommending this triple therapy.
Today, Drs. Petrie and Fava joined the podcast to discuss new guidelines for the screening, treatment, and management of lupus nephritis in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michelle Petrie. I'm a professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and for the last 35, 36 years, I've been director of the Hopkins Lupus Center.
And I'm Dr. Andrea Fava. I direct the Lupus Translational Research Program, and I'm an assistant professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland.
Thank you for joining me, Andrea. We saw patients all day long, and now we're still together.
It's never too much. It's my pleasure to be here, Michelle.
Now, as you know, because you were part of it, the ACR has issued new guidelines for the treatment of lupus nephritis. And this is important because in the mycophenolate era, we haven't been doing very well. The one-year complete renal response is only about 20% of our patients. So what is the major finding in the new guidelines?
Well, I agree. The newer guidelines, I think they come with this big innovation, which is recommending this triple therapy. So mycophenolate or low-dose cyclophosphamide, that remains the foundation of the initial treatment for lupus nephritis. But what's new is that now, in addition to that, there is a second agent, and it's a conditional recommendation to add either belimumab or a calcineurin inhibitor, such as tacrolimus or voclosporin. And that's for all patients, whether they have class 3, 4, or 5 lupus nephritis. And that's because of the many clinical trials that have been using different agents that have shown that adding an agent to standards of care increased the rate of response, particularly given how underwhelming the rates have been with traditional regimens, about 20%+. So the other update is that this triple therapy, which is an immunosuppressant, the second agent, and prednisone, is recommended over dual therapy for class 3 or 4 lupus nephritis in certain patients. The idea is that combining agents with different mechanisms may lead to better outcomes, although that's not mandatory for every patient.
I like to summarize this as mycophenolate plus, that it's not enough to have just mycophenolate anymore. But it's kind of confusing, isn't it, which of the new agents to add, whether it should be belimumab or a calcineurin inhibitor. Belimumab, of course, makes sense if you have what I'm going to call a vulnerable patient, so somebody who has a history of infections or a history of malignancy. Can you tell us the approach you took in the guidelines?
Absolutely. So the guidelines emphasize tailoring therapy to patient features. So for example, calcineurin inhibitors are generally preferred when patients come with a high level of protein in the urine, usually above 3 grams a day, is called nephrotic range, provided that their kidney function is preserved, meaning above about 45%, and the blood pressure is well controlled. So the calcineurin inhibitors tend to reduce proteinuria faster than belimumab and may be particularly helpful when a rapid proteinuria lowering effect is desired. In contrast, belimumab may be more appropriate for patients with significant extrarenal disease, for example, if they have joint disease or skin findings, or if they have low kidney function, where adding a calcineurin inhibitor may come with a higher risk, or they may also, it would fail to cover the other manifestations. So in these patients, belimumab may be appealing, also because belimumab may have actually has a lower pill burden.
Zero.
So for patients that do not have high-risk features, the guideline recommends individualizing treatment based on patient preferences. And so belimumab has shown a strong effect in preventing flares and improving kidney function over time, which can be valuable in the broader lupus management. So ultimately, these are guidelines. These are not mandates. So they leave room for clinical judgment. So this is a framework that is helpful for initial decision, but we need to consider how these agents can be used sequentially in combination and how they would fit the desires and characteristics of each patient.
So I've spent most of my career trying to prevent the dependence on prednisone. So one of my quarrels with the new guidelines is they actually state that prednisone can be used up to 40 milligrams. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I agree. That feels like it's still too much, right? So high-dose steroids remain a concern, obviously, and there was plenty of internal discussion about this. There is evidence that low-dose prednisone can be enough, and there are even wonderful studies that show that no prednisone can be needed. So the guideline recommendation was ultimately based on the protocols that were used in randomized clinical trials, and that's what carried the biggest influence. Except for the voclosporin trial, which was very brave for using at most 25 milligrams of prednisone with a very fast taper, the other trials use higher doses. Now, again, these are conditional recommendations, and that means that the panel was not confident about the risk-benefit balance because of the absence of sufficient evidence. This is where physicians should use their clinical judgment and interpret all of the evidence to make treatment decisions to provide the safest and most effective treatment beyond the trial protocols. So it's important that the guidelines now suggest to reduce prednisone to less than 5 milligrams by 6 months if the patient is responding well. And that's lower than the previous guidance, reflecting the goal of reducing long-term use of steroid.
I also have a concern about class 5 in the new guidelines. Class 5, when it's pure class 5, usually doesn't cause loss of GFR for decades. So I think we have time to allow our agents to work without prednisone. And in particular, I worry about prednisone in class 5 because people with class 5 are more hypercoagulable. They're more subject to infection because they become hypogammaglobulinemic and they're hyperlipidemic. And you give prednisone to those patients, this is going to worsen all those comorbidities. And in addition, patients with class 5 have done the worst in the clinical trials, to the point that one of the most recent clinical trials excluded class 5. So explain how the guidelines handled class 5.
Yeah, I agree. It is, so this is not exactly how many of us treat class 5. And there is a problem on what is the best approach to class 5. There is very little evidence, very little high-quality evidence on how to best treat class 5. And again, this in the guideline was another conditional recommendation. So the evidence guiding the recommendation came from the available clinical trials that included pure class 5. And in these trials, class 5 was treated by protocol, like class 3 and 4. So in the absence of dedicated clinical trials, which we need, the panel ultimately decided that there was no strong evidence to recommend a different protocol. So management of class 5 is a big unmet need in lupus nephritis, but now with many clinical trials excluding class 5, the gap is only going to grow further. So the guideline do mention that for pure class 5, if a patient has proteinuria above 1 gram, it may be reasonable to consider triple therapy with mycophenolate and another agent. But again, the evidence is low quality. There is significant uncertainty, and I think that the prednisone is going to be something where clinicians really should use their judgment, use their interpretation, their intelligent interpretation of the evidence, and make the best decision for the patient in front of them.
Now, another important update is how long should we treat the patient? The EULAR guidelines had said treat 3 to 5 years. But as you know, we see very severe lupus nephritis in the United States. And I have many patients who need treatment way beyond 5 years. So can you comment again on the approach the guidelines took?
Yeah, that's correct. So the guidelines suggest continuing therapy for at least 3 to 5 years after achieving complete renal response. Now, that's because the risk of persistent histological activity continues. However, there are patients who may take a very long time to achieve that response, and patients who, even if they look like they achieved response, they may still harbor histological activity, which means that inside the kidney there is inflammation, even though we don't see it from proteinuria. And so I think that we need to have a nuanced approach to that. We need to remember that sometimes just using proteinuria is not sufficient. And there are nephrologists who argue that a repeat biopsy is necessary to truly establish if someone has responded before we start tapering immunosuppression. But 3 to 5 years, according to the observational evidence that's available, it seems to be the bare minimum.
Now, the guidelines also took a position on how often to check to see if someone had newly developed lupus nephritis. And as I remember it, it said that it was okay to sometimes check yearly. But my view is if you have a high-risk patient in front of you, which means a younger person, someone non-Caucasian race, someone who has active serologies like low complement or anti-DNA, you should check every chance you get. So what happened in the guidelines?
Well, what I can say is that I agree with you that I think that proteinuria should be checked every time you have a patient in front of you. And we usually check it every 3 to 6 months, which is more or less what the guidelines say. It is about every 6 months. But the 3 to 6 months is very reasonable. And we, for patients who have any sort of real lupus activity, we don't see the patient any less often than every 6 months. And so I think that 3 to 6 months is helpful, is the right indication, and that's a practical way to help us detect also relapses earlier.
Now, the guidelines do mention shared decision-making, and I think this is most important in a young woman who may desire pregnancy. And this is because neither mycophenolate nor voclosporin can be used in pregnancy. What was your view in the guidelines?
Well, the ACR guidelines, actually, so the ACR committee has issued like a very helpful set of guidelines for reproductive health and pregnancy that is separate, that provides general recommendation. I think that in the setting of pregnancy, there's a lot of tailoring that needs to be made to select the agents that are considered safe for pregnancy, but also ideally in a lupus patient, we should truly plan the pregnancy for the best moment in order to avoid problem and find the right plan. Sometimes we need to be a little bit, I mean, we want to follow the science, but when the patient is in front of us and there is such heterogeneity in the lupus patient, we need to be a little bit of an artist and really craft the plan for them. So we take guidance from the guidelines and ultimately is a clinician decision that makes the best plan for the patient.
Hendry, I want to thank you for your insights as an insider on these guidelines and also for being a good sport, for my being critical a part of them.
Well, as always, enjoy the conversation. I always learn from you, even from the toughest questions.
And I want to thank our audience for watching.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, or TuneIn. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, "What's my flash briefing?" Thanks today to our guest, Drs. Petrie and Fava. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.